Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Bière sur vin est venin, vin sur bière est belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meat in Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coral Lee. Takayuki Suda, or Gaku, has been researching Japanese Americans across generations and the extent to which they remain connected to their ethnic heritage. Welcome to the show, Gaku.
Thank you very much, Coral. It's good to be on your podcast.
Sure. So let's first talk about you and your own history as a Japanese American in America. Where are you living now?
So I'm currently in Scottsdale, Arizona, right north of Phoenix.
And what has brought you here?
So I'm a professor of anthropology at Arizona State University. So I moved out here from UC San Diego 14 years ago. So that's how I ended up in the middle of the Sonoran Desert here in Arizona.
Mm-hmm. And before San Diego, did you grow up in California or did your parents immigrate?
So my father immigrated to the United States in the late 1960s. In fact, I believe he was one of the first Japanese immigrants to immigrate here after World War II, because as you may know, the U.S. government banned Asian immigration, or most Asian immigration, until 1965. And so he came to the United States as a graduate student at the University of Chicago. So I was actually born and raised on the campus of the University of Chicago. So I'm actually a Midwesterner.
And so can you actually give a brief history as to the migration of Japanese to America? Like you mentioned, there was the flux post-World War II, but can you give a bit more context?
So Japanese immigration to the United States has a very long history. Japanese Americans are one of the oldest Asian American groups here in the United States. And so the immigration of Japanese to the United States started in the 1880s. And initially, most of that went to Hawaii. And these were Japanese farmers who were suffering in the rural Japanese countryside and immigrated to Hawaii to work as plantation workers. And then after that, there started to be immigration from Japan to the mainland United States. And that continued in significant numbers until 1924. That's when the U.S. government passed the Immigration Act of 1924, which banned Asian immigration to the United States. So there was actually a significant low in Japanese immigration from 1924 until 1965, when the Hart-Sutter Act was passed here in the United States, which allowed Asians to immigrate here both as students, employees, and through family reunification. So there's a there was a significant amount of Japanese immigration to the United States before 1924, and most Japanese Americans today are descendants of those earlier Japanese immigrants. So most of these Japanese Americans are third and fourth generation here in the United States. And then, as I just mentioned, there was a post-war immigration of Japanese, not as large because Japan had become a prosperous country, so there wasn't that much of an economic incentive to immigrate to the United States anymore. And the descendants of those, the post-war 1965 Japanese immigrants are called Shinnise, that is the new second generation. So I'm actually part of that generation.
Mm-hmm. I actually want to get back to the Exclusion Act. How did immigration differ before the act and after? And what was the appeal of immigrating to a place that was previously exclusionary?
Well, so before 1924, most of the immigration of Japanese was due to economic reasons. So Japan was modernizing, but there were significant economic disparities in Japan. I mean, the cities were starting to do quite well and become modernized in Japan, but the rural areas in Japan were really left behind. So there were a lot of poor rural farmers suffering in Japan at that time. And the United States, of course, there was a decline in white European immigration, and there was, of course, still a great need for immigrant labor, especially to work in American agriculture. So so the Japanese government and the U.S. government arranged the immigration of Japanese to the United States. And so that ended in 1924. So after 1965, so that was, you know, World War II had ended. Japan was becoming a highly developed first world nation. Relationships between Japan and the United States had already improved considerably. And American images toward Japanese in Japan had become much more favorable. Discrimination toward Japanese Americans in the United States had started to subside after World War II. So the Japanese who immigrated after 1965 did not experience as much prejudice and discrimination as the Japanese who immigrated before 1924. And so most of these Japanese were generally highly educated professionals and business people, both people who, like my father, came as students to America. There were others who came as independent professionals. And then, especially in the 1980s, because of the booming Japanese economy and Japanese multinational firms spreading across the world, you started to get Japanese business people immigrating here with their families, mainly for temporary corporate stays in the U.S., working for Japanese corporations in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's this really quick and happy turnaround, but where in this timeline do the enforced incarcerations happen, yes, and how come those aren't talked about as much?
Well, that's a big part of Japanese American history. There's been a ton of scholarly research done on the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. In fact, most of the research, especially historical research done on Japanese Americans, is about the internment. And so, as I think most Americans know by now, I know when I was growing up, this wasn't taught actively in American schools, but I talked to my young students at Arizona State University now, and most of them are taught this very dark moment in American history when the American government incarcerated basically almost all of the Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans living here in the United States after Japan attacked Pearl Harbor because they were seen as a national security threat. There was, of course, no evidence that of treasonous activity among Japanese immigrants or Japanese Americans, but there was a lot of mass hysteria in the United States after Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. So this unilateral decision was made by the Roosevelt administration. And it's very important to remember that two-thirds of the Japanese and Japanese Americans who were actually interned in concentration camps during World War II in the United States were actually American citizens. These were second generation U.S.-born Japanese Americans who were being interned. And like I just said, two-thirds of the Japanese population that was interned was actually American citizens. Mm-hmm. So we were locking up Americans.
Yeah, and then on the flip side of that is then the forced assimilation after that. And then I was wondering if you could see any ties between the assimilation efforts and the reason why there are larger Japanese communities in certain pockets of America today.
So after World War II, the American government, so after the internment camps were closed and the Japanese Americans were freed, at the end of the war, the American government actually was worried, ironically, that if a lot of these Japanese Americans returned to California, where they had been living before World War II, that they would face severe prejudice and discrimination and hate crimes and so on, because most of the Japanese Americans had been living in California, and that's where the backlash against Japanese Americans was by far the worst in the United States. And so the Japanese Americans, after the internment experience, were encouraged to not return to California. Of course, a lot of them did, but others decided to scatter across the United States. So a good number of them migrated internally to the Midwest. And so you have, you know, Japanese American communities in places like Chicago, where I was born and raised, and then you had Japanese Americans moving to the East Coast, and so you have Japanese American communities, a history of that on the East Coast as well. And so the U.S.-born second-generation Japanese Americans who were incarcerated in these internment camps, after World War II, they realized that it was quite unfortunate that, you know, despite being American citizens, they had been locked up simply because they're Japanese descent. So being Japanese, of course, was a huge stigma after World War II. And of course, they continued to face prejudice and discrimination from mainstream Americans. So the message that the second generation got is that they had to Americanize and assimilate as quickly as possible and demonstrate their loyalty as Americans. This is why a good number of them actually fought against the Germans in Europe during World War II and the 442nd. I mean, a lot of them died trying to demonstrate their loyalty, that they were willing to die for their country of America just as much as white Americans fighting the Nazis in Europe. So there was a huge push among the second generation to assimilate after World War II and become, you know, loyal Americans. And that, of course, continued to the third and fourth generation. So by the time you get to the third generation, they're completely assimilated, don't speak a word of Japanese. They've lost touch with their Japanese cultural heritage and all of that.
And is this the same across members of the Japanese diaspora across countries, or is this solely in America?
This was mainly in the United States and in Canada. I don't know much about the history of Japanese Canadians during World War II, but some of what I've read and heard is that actually the Canadian government treated their Japanese descendants, the Japanese Canadians, in some ways worse than the Americans did. So the Japanese Canadians kind of had a similar experience. Now, there are large communities of Japanese descendants in Latin America, especially in Brazil and Peru, but there's smaller groups in countries like Argentina and Paraguay and even Bolivia. And they were also there during World War II. But the Japanese descendants in Latin America were not incarcerated in concentration camps. Actually, the U.S. government tried to pressure some of these Latin American nations to send their Japanese descendants to the United States to be placed in internment camps. And most of the Latin American countries did not do that, with the exception of Peru. And so Peru actually sent, it wasn't their entire population, but a segment of the Japanese Peruvian population to the United States to be placed in these internment camps with Japanese Americans. And so as a result, you have some Japanese Peruvian communities here in the United States who, after they were World War II, they decided not to go back. Well, a lot of them went back, but some of them decided not to go back to Peru, and they just settled here in the United States. So I believe there's a Japanese Peruvian community somewhere in New Jersey that traces its history to the American internment experience.
Wow. Yeah, and so if you were to gather a third-generation Japanese-American with a third-generation Japanese-Peruvian into the same room, how might they differ in terms of values or, how might they differ?
You mean a third-generation Japanese-Peruvian who's been living in the United States?
Who's been living in Peru. Well,
who's living in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
Despite being members of the same Japanese diaspora, that is descendants of Japanese who scattered throughout the Americas, Japanese Americans feel quite different from Japanese Latin Americans. And I actually asked about this during my research, and those Japanese Americans who actually met in the past Japanese descendants from Latin America basically said that they couldn't find too many commonalities. I mean, first of all, the language is different. Of course, the Japanese Americans speak English, and the Japanese Latin Americans speak Spanish, or if they're Japanese Brazilian, speak Portuguese. And because both of these communities, Japanese descendants in the U.S. and in Latin America, have been living in completely different countries for generations of, they've assimilated to these separate countries. So Japanese Americans act like Americans and think like Americans, and Japanese Peruvians act and think like Peruvians, and their worldview is very different. So even when communication is possible, they find they don't have a lot in common to talk about, except the fact that their ancestors came from Japan, and that's about it. And that's basically what the Japanese Americans told me, that they really found these people. It was like just meeting any person from Peru. They didn't find the ancestral commonalities that they expected because of generations of assimilation to separate countries.
Right. And then to push on this further, how might a first generation differ from a third generation, both Japanese Americans living in America?
So the first generation currently in the United States are the immigrants who came after 1965, and they are quite separated from the older Japanese-American community, like I said, who are third and fourth generation. So the first generation immigrants, they're generally wealthier and highly educated Japanese who came here for student and professional reasons or as businessmen. So some of them actually do have prejudices about these older communities of Japanese Americans who are descended from poorer Japanese rural farmers who immigrated here before 1924. And then there are differences in culture. Of course, the Japanese current first-generation immigrants are, culturally Japanese, and they speak Japanese much better than English, and the Japanese-Americans are Americanized, and they don't speak Japanese, and they live in separate communities. They don't interact much with each other, and so there's really a divide between the current Issei, the first-generation Japanese immigrants, and these later-generation Japanese-Americans. Again, they don't have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm. And so how do collective identities or even quote-unquote ethnicities get formed across generations?
I think these are very different identities. I think the first-generation Japanese immigrants don't necessarily identify that strongly with the U.S., even if they end up settling here. A lot of them are temporary, so they're planning to go back to Japan after their degrees or after their work in Japanese multinationals here in the U.S., which is usually only like several years. They just get transferred here from Japan. And the Japanese Americans of the third and fourth generation, of course, they identify heavily as Americans, and they feel much more loyalty and national identification with the United States than they do to Japan. Of course, they continue. They are proud of their Japanese ancestral heritage, and they continue to say things like, you know, there are parts of me that are related to, I feel the pull of Japanese culture to my ancestors and so on, and some traits that they attribute to their Japanese descent. But besides that, they're very assimilated, and they identify quite strongly as Americans of Japanese descent. So there's definitely a bit. I would never characterize the Japanese American community is so diverse. I cannot characterize it as having some kind of unified identity.
Mm-hmm. This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back after a short break.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Diane Stemple.
And I'm Elena Santigade, and we're the hosts of Cutting the Curd here on Heritage Radio Network. Featuring interviews with makers and mongers and everybody in between, this show is a downright funky look at the world of artisan cheese.
You can find Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We were just talking about how collective identities get formed across generations, if at all possible. And so, Gaku, having been in America as long as, if not longer, other immigrants, why are Asian Americans, or specifically Japanese Americans, still constantly having to defend their Americanness?
That's a very good question, and it's something I did research on. I think most Americans, and when I say Americans, I'm not just talking about white Americans, I'm also talking about American people of color here in the United States, I think continue to have the image that the typical American is white or black. And that's because the population of white Americans is still the minority, and we all know that African Americans have been here since the time of slavery. And so when people think of Asians or they see an Asian face, they have this assumption that, oh, these people must be immigrants. They must have come recently from countries in Asia. And in some ways that is empirically accurate, because two-thirds of the Asian population here in the United States is actually first-generation immigrants. Which means only one-third are U.S.-born Asian Americans who have American citizenship. So if you look at a population like Japanese Americans, like I said, most of them are third and fourth generation, and they're completely Americanized. They don't speak Japanese. They don't have much of a connection to Japan. And they think and act and talk like Americans. Culturally, they're very, they're completely Americanized, but because they look Asian, they look Japanese. When they meet people for the first time, these people assume, oh, you must, they're asked, where are you from? What's your nationality? Why do you speak English so well? You know, these types of microaggressions, which are based on the assumption that because you look Asian, you must not be American, that you are a foreigner. And it's a it's a type of treatment that makes Asian Americans, Japanese Americans in particular, because they've been here for so long, but I think this is shared among other Asian Americans, making them feel that despite being here for being born and raised here in the U.S. and being here for a number of generations, in some cases, they are not still not seen as Americans. Again, despite the fact that they're culturally assimilated and Americanized. So they constantly have to kind of assert their Americanness in the U.S. You know, it's something that like a white American or an African American would never have to deal with. And some of the Japanese Americans I interviewed refused to answer that question when people ask them where are they from, because they find it kind of insulting, you know. Mm-hmm. And marginalizing, so they say, I'm from Phoenix. And then, of course, the person says, no, where are you originally from, or really from? And then they say, I was born in Chicago, and then my parents were born in Los Angeles. You know, they just, they don't want to be marginalized by outsiders. They want to demonstrate to other Americans that, look, I'm just as American as you are. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this kind of gets back to our conversation about assimilation earlier in this episode. We were talking about the historical efforts where government felt uncomfortable about sending these Japanese populations to California, so they were scattered across America, and what other efforts were taken to encourage the assimilation?
Well, I don't. I think the fact that the government encouraged them to scatter itself is facilitates assimilation, because, you know, if you live in an ethnic enclave with a lot of co-ethnics like the Japanese did before World War II, then there's going to naturally be more retention of the culture and the language and so on. I mean, you find this among Mexican and Mexican-American communities that live kind of segregated in immigrant communities in Los Angeles, for instance. So the fact that the American government encouraged Japanese Americans to scatter around the country during World War II meant that their communities became dispersed among white American communities. And so that itself, I think, was another factor that accelerated their assimilation here in the United States. And besides that, I would not say the government put any other specific pressures on Japanese Americans to assimilate and become more Americanized. I think it was more an effort among the Japanese Americans to do so, because they realized that their Japanese heritage was unwanted cultural baggage and that it would lead to discrimination and prejudice after World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you in your books, you've identified these ways in which various generations of Japanese Americans respond to these pressures, whether for and against. And can you give some examples of a few ways?
So it's kind of ironic. If you look at current generations of Japanese Americans, there's the, like I mentioned before, the post-war Shin-Nisei, more recent second generation, the post-war second generation, people like myself. And these Shin-Nisei actually grow up they're quite different from other Japanese Americans, because we grew up in a very, you know, bicultural, transnational kind of lifestyle, where our parents sent us to Japanese Saturday schools, and we took Japanese classes with students from Japan on Saturdays, and our parents took us back to Japan often because they were, you know, high-skilled professionals and students. And so we grew up pretty connected to the Japanese language and culture. So when the Shin-Nisei, the post-war second generation, get asked, where are you from? They're not as bothered by it because, you know, after all, they're only second generation and they still have close linguistic and cultural ties to Japan. But by the time you get to the third and fourth generation, like I mentioned before, they're pretty annoyed by the fact that despite the fact that they've been in the United States for generations, they continue to be seen as some kind of foreigner and not completely American. Now, the way the third and fourth generation Japanese Americans react, I mean, it's kind of a kind of a dual type of reaction. On one hand, they are bothered by the fact that they continue to be seen as foreigners, and so they want to assert their Americanness and demonstrate that they're culturally Americanized. But on the other hand, this has, especially among the fourth generation, led to some regret about the loss of their Japanese cultural heritage and language. And this is also due to the fact that in this multicultural age, like being ethnic, you know, and having ties to your ethnic origins and speaking your native language, kind of cool. And also images of Japan. I mean, there are lots of Americans who are fascinated by Japan and Japanese culture and manga and anime and ninjas and samurai and so on. And so some of these fourth generation Japanese Americans, I mean, they feel so, they say they feel so whitewashed that they've completely Americanized and lost their Japanese ancestral culture. And especially because Americans continue to racialize them as Japanese and wonder, why can't you speak Japanese, or why don't you know about Japan, you know? So they've reacted to this kind of racialization as foreigners by actually trying to recover their lost Japanese ethnic heritage. And this was one of the most fascinating things that I found in my research. And so they decide to start studying the Japanese language, and especially during college, go to Japan on student exchange programs and start getting fascinated with Japanese popular culture. And so the fourth generation, after generations of Americanization and assimilation, has actually kind of tried to return and recover their lost Japanese ancestral heritage, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. With the irony, it feels almost as if the Asian American experience kind of exists on a bell curve. As soon as we are as white as possible, we are then most compelled to connect to our Asian or lost Asian heritage. And so what are some ways that the younger generations are doing so?
Well, so like I mentioned, these are mainly, so the fourth generation are still quite young, and they're mainly, they're millennial generation college students. And so what's interesting about the way they try to reconnect and recover their Japanese ancestral heritage is that they don't go to Japanese American communities to do that here in the U.S. because they know Japanese Americans have lost their heritage. And yeah, I mean, Japanese Americans do practice some Japanese cultural activities if you go to some of these community events, but it's not seen as the authentic Japanese culture, which is understood to come from the ancestral homeland of Japan. So most of these fourth generation Japanese American youth try to reconnect with their heritage by going directly to the source, which is Japan. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, that includes taking Japanese language classes in college from instructors from Japan, going to Japan as college exchange students to explore their heritage in Japan, and then getting in touch with Japanese popular culture, which is, of course, from Japan, not from the United States. And so, and I should also mention that it was very, when you said that there's kind of this bell curve to the trajectory of Asian Americans, where, you know, initially they're not assimilated and as they become Americanized, and then later on there's this effort to recover heritage. This was actually found among white Americans as well. Hmm. White Americans of the third and fourth generation who are like Italian American, who end up feeling they lost their ethnicity and they want to, you know, explore their Italianness and go back to Italy and things like that. So it's something that's happened to American ethnics before.
That's really interesting. And so it's happening to all of us kind of on the same timeline.
It happens across the generations. I think in general, the second generation is still trying to get ahead and assimilate and trying to make it in American society and realize the American dream. And by the time you get to the third and fourth generation, they have lost their heritage, and they also feel secure enough here in the United States, especially socioeconomically and educationally, that and especially in this multicultural era, that kind of reasserting your ethnic heritage is no longer going to lead to significant ethnic stigma or anything. So I definitely think it happens across the generations in that manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that really interesting and had not considered that at all, because as we were talking earlier, even though a Japanese American might be here for four or five generations, it's still, they seem the furthest from being considered American. And so it's kind of comforting to know that other people are experiencing same things.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so lastly, I just wanted to ask, why did you choose San Diego and Phoenix as your kind of case study cities for your books?
Well, I mean, I wish I could say there was some logical research purpose to all this, but I basically chose these communities because those were the two that I was living in. So because I was a faculty member at UC San Diego, there's, of course, a large, in Southern California in general, large Asian American communities, including Japanese American communities. And so I had the opportunity to study a Japanese American community, which I, like I said, is still third and fourth, mainly third and fourth generation, but continues to remain quite cohesive and with organizations and cultural activities and gatherings and meetings and so on. And then when I moved to here to Phoenix to start my job at Arizona State University, I was able to encounter a very different Japanese American community here, which is actually much smaller than the ones in Southern California. And some of the Japanese American Americans who live here in Phoenix actually were interned in concentration camps during World War II here in Arizona. I mean, there have been some prominent, there were some prominent internment camps here in Gila River and Poston and so on. And so they are a product of the Japanese Americans who just decided to stay here after they were interned in Arizona. And so this was not by design, but I, because of where I lived, I was able to study two quite different Japanese American communities. So it diversified my research sample.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting, especially given that California was initially seen as kind of hostile and the non-ideal place for Japanese Americans to return to. What since has allowed it to become a welcoming place?
Well, I think in general, American, like I said before, American attitudes toward Japan increased and improved dramatically since World War II. I mean, of course, Japan ended up becoming one of the most longest and staunchest allies of the United States in East Asia. And over time, prejudice toward Japanese Americans subsided as we grew more distant from World War II. Japan modernized and became an advanced industrialized country. And there was a period where there were trade tensions between Japan and the U.S., like there is between the U.S. and China right now, but that has also subsided. Just the increase in Asian immigration, I mean, when the Japanese American, before World War II, the Japanese and Chinese were the only significant Asian American communities here in the U.S., and they were very small. But since World War II, you've had a huge increase in Asian immigration, not just from East Asia, but from Southeast Asia and South Asia as well. And so I think Americans have gotten more used to Asian immigrants and Asian Americans. And I think that has increased racial tolerance, despite the fact that they continue to not be seen as American. I do think racial tolerance toward Asian Americans has improved dramatically since the time when, you know, Japanese Americans were thrown into concentration camps because they were Japanese descent.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's a really optimistic way of looking at it, but it's hard not to see the analogy between the modern-day migrant detention centers from the incarceration of the Japanese Americans now.
Yes. You mean like Muslim Americans?
Yeah.
or the immigrants from Central America who are now being detained in ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Detention Centers. I mean, the strongest analogy with Japanese American internment during World War II is the detention. A lot of Americans don't know this. After 9/11, the United States government detained 2,700 Muslim and Muslim Americans here in the United States in an effort to try to catch terrorists. And some of these Muslim immigrants and Muslim Americans were put in these detention centers for months. And after this entire dragnet effort, they actually caught no terrorists. And so this was a complete violation of Muslim American civil liberties. And, so when this was happening, some of the leaders of the Japanese American community got very upset because they realized, oh my God, this is happening again. You know, what happened, what the U.S. government did to us a generation ago, they're still now doing to the current generation of, you know, whichever immigrant group happens to be the antagonist of the United States gets thrown into, or the enemy of the United States gets thrown into, detention centers. And so the Japanese Americans were the ones who protested the most loudly against this internment of Muslim Americans by basically saying, has the U.S. government not learned anything from its past history, that you can't just throw an entire nationality into jail just because their ancestral homeland happens to be at war with the United States, whether it was World War II or the war against terrorism.
Mm-hmm. What a great way to end our episode. Thank you so much for joining me today, Takayuki.
Yeah, thank you very much, Coral. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.